This is a tape on Helen Campbell, Kistiawks Valley. Helen, I'd like you to tell all about your trip from California. I understand in 1928.
Yes, that was in 1928. And we started out with a trailer full of goods and goats, and so forth, and it turned out the tires on the trailer were too small, you know, to carry the load. So we were having trouble with both, and we just decided to abandon the thing and bring bare necessities. So we called up a friend who came to where we had gone truck, and he took most of our things back, and the goats and everything else. He was going to take care of them. And
so you never did take those things in?
And sell what? And then they sent some things, we shipped some things, freight, some dishes and, you know, things like that. And then we put one of, that's why we decided we had to have one of the milk goats with us on account of the children, and we didn't know what we were getting into. We didn't know what the milk supply would be up here. So that's just how that came about. We rode down the running board behind a little sort of air screen that we bolted on there, and it's a that both she and the baby didn't get way up here to stuff.
She had a little baby goat, of course.
No, she was feeding my baby. And every place we stopped, attendants at the service stations and everything else, especially if there was a little combined with it, as there so often is, they fed that everything from cigarette butts to cabbage leaves, you know.
The great excitement over this thing.
Yes, they had never seen a caravan like that go up the road. We would drive.
And I understand it was a two-door Hudson sedan.
Yes, it was a two-door Hudson sedan, and the back was just built up even with the seat. We turned the kids and the dog loose in there so that they weren't restricted. We didn't have to worry about them falling out either.
What age were the children?
Winifred was 3 and Teddy was 6 months.
So he was the one that was getting the goat milk.
Jim was in between, you see.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, we would go to what looked like a nice camp lot, and there weren't any restrictions on camping in those either, you know, beside the road, as long as you had a campfire permit. And we'd pull off in plenty to make ourselves a good supper. We'd jump off and graze around, but she never left the camp.
Did you hobble her, or did she
she wouldn't leave us.
She was too scared.
Partly that, probably, strange place. And partly she was just as a pet as the dog was.
And now, did you have it, or did you just sleep in the car?
Well, the children slept in the car, and most of the time we just slept out in the open. We had it with us, but nearly all the way the weather was nice. And we didn't, at most of our stopping places, we didn't pitch the tent once, actually.
So you know, just roll up in your blanket?
Yes.
It's not an attachment.
Well, it was a pleasant trip, you know.
So, and that took, do you know how long it took you?
Well, it was 3 days to the border. And that's from Central California. And it took 5 days driving from the border to Hazleton. The road was pretty hairy in spots, you know. There were none of those tunnels on the Fraser Canyon, and that you crept out around and the river was way down below, and it was just straight up above.
Sometimes you have to back up if there's...
Oh, there were miles that there was not room to pass. If troops met, somebody had to back up to the widest place. They were doing road work on the canyon at that time. They were widening the road, you know. And they had houses and scrapers. No, no mechanical equipment at all, horses and
animals. So you'd pass all that stuff?
Yes, and we'd have to wait until the path cleared if we got there at the wrong time.
Did you have a lot of flats with this car, or?
No, we didn't. We were fortunate that way. When we got in St. George, we hadn't been used to these long days. And coming north and driving north at, you know, fairly rapidly, say in the day's time, it sort of creeps up on you, because when we went to Prince George, we saw that the tube was sticking out on one of the casings, and that said we'd better go into the service station, you see. And there were no service stations open at that time of the day, 11 o'clock, and we thought it was about supper time.
This would be in the spring of the year that you'd be traveling.
Yes, that was in June, you see.
June.
The days were really long.
Oh, isn't that? So you were then forced to stay over.
So we just pulled out of Prince George away and up someplace this side of the top of Clucas Hill.
Oh, yeah.
There was a friend over there. We were over there, well, not too many years ago. And he showed place. He said, right here is approximately where you camped. And we came in and then, of course, fixed the tire ourselves.
And what made you decide on Hazleton?
We didn't really decide on Hazleton. We were good for the Nass Valley. And we had were buying a small piece of property there, which is now where the S camp is located. But the road go clear through. On the map, it showed what looked like a wagon going through or something. And we were used to roads, so we can get through there. We were used to mountain roads. But we found out that these little roads didn't connect up, couldn't get any further than, Sealy Lake along there. And the road was through as, well, I don't know, about as far as Carnaby, but it was nothing but a wagon road, stumps in the middle of the road and everything.
So in other words, it probably went by horseback or
and,
something.
And wagons.
Oh, at wagons.
We had to, yes, high-wheeled wagons, and we had to, we thought, well, we'll camp here for a while.
Yes, is that it?
That's it, just around the corner and down a little from South Hazleton.
Woodcock, I guess.
And, not too far from the corner.
Oh, yeah.
You know where you turn at Pat Leary's.
Oh, yeah.
And we went up on the hillside there, and we were making a camp, and it was drizzling and raining and miserable, and there was an old bachelor lived down the road just a little bit, and he, of course, was about these people, because people just didn't come in like that in the place. And he came walking up, and he said, well, he said, have a shed down there that camp in, if you like, it'll be dry at least, there's a good roof. He said he didn't have, his house was too small to accommodate us, but we could camp in there, which we did. We went down there and camped in the shed.
You must have looked something like gypsies.
I think so. he died later in the Hazleton Hospital. It was quite an old time. We thought we would camp and then maybe go in horseback
to the Nass.
Yes, and see what.
So I suppose Ted had this all figured out in California. That's
well, yes, we had planned, and he went up to see the others about horses. They sort of interested us in staying here, and then of course some of the people said, well, no other access in there except by pack horse or the river, you know. And so So we found this place and liked it. And so how nice. It's just sort of an accident, first place, you know.
So you this, of course, you homesteaded.
But now it'd be hard to move us.
Of course.
Well, no, this was deeded property, this quarter here. And the man had gone away to World War I. He was originally from Wisconsin.
Oh.
And he worked on the telegraph line up here for years.
Oh.
And then he went to the war. And I don't think he ever came here. He went back to Wisconsin. I'm not sure, but I think his father had died or something. And he went back there to take the dairy farm.
Oh, yeah.
The family. And he never came back up here, so he had just this in the hands of the real estate.
Oh, I see. So there was a house then when you came to?
Well, there was a little hut, you might say, that he had built that was his house, but on the site where this house stands, there was a hall, a log building, just about the same size as this, that had been built for a Salvation Army hall with people around, because on the next roof, I don't know what his rank was, whether he was captain or what.
Of the Salvation Army.
Salvation.
Oh.
Living at that time. And this, right on this quarter, donated this little spot for them to put
in this hall.
Salvation Army.
So there must be quite a Salvation Army people there.
I think there must have been.
And they all together and built it, I suppose.
Well, not only Salvation Army people, but others as well, because I know Eric's uncle, Charlie Genzi, worked on the building, and I think he did some of the broad axe work. It was beautifully hewn inside of big cedar logs. They probably had a 14 or 18 inch face, a lot of them.
So that this became your home?
Yes.
Oh,
and they were just as smooth as glass. You know.
So this was your original home until after when you had your...
So all we had was, we took the ceiling off and hewed out good, heavier timbers to make floor joists, and the ceiling on the top of it to make a floor. And we,
so the kids could sleep upstairs.
So we had them upstairs.
And the kids slept upstairs.
Yes.
How about that?
We had plenty of room.
Hmm. And you lived in that for?
Lived in that until it burned down. And then
that's.
We were. Ted was at the dry dock working, you know. We were beginning to get a little more cash, and we were building on to it, you know. Just about the time it burned down.
So what year was that it burned down?
January of 44.
January 44. And of course, it would be from a heater, I suppose.
Well, I imagine it was a. It must have been a chimney fire because Jim and myself were up at the other school.
Oh,
no, we were hauling hay. You see, we were cattle up there,
oh.
And then we would bring a load of hay. And I think I hauled about 70 ton of hay home that winter, and Teddy was staying with his sister going to school because he needed more advanced schooling.
Oh, that's in a different place.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And there was just glares. They would go to school down the road here, and then they would start supper and get chores done. So when we arrived home, the roof, you know, upstairs floor and everything, in, it was all burning just inside of these log walls.
Right, about right in the middle of the day?
Well, that would be along towards evening, you know. It was dark, because in January, you know,
So suppose the boy's got a cracking fire going and got
Bruce said he had closed the damper. I checked the stove after, everything was cooled off, and the damper closed. But in the draft,
so it
must have been just smoldering in the chimney, because they said when they looked up from the barn, you know, the roof was on fire, and they got up here and shingles had already fallen into the bedrooms upstairs. So, you know, nothing they could do about it.
Oh dear.
Although, did get a few things out, and it's I'm just lucky they didn't get burned, you know.
I'll see.
Because Glenn's feet were with light in his rubbers, just like he'd been wearing them out in a hot summer.
And then, of course, Winnie was away.
She wasn't home. She was going to school.
So when you got here, that was 1928 when you got here again.
Yes.
And you were living. This was when you went, or at least, no, you didn't keep farming at the time, I guess. Not immediately.
Not until 1940. Ted would say it was when he left for the dry dock. He wasn't at home when we hauled the fish home.
And what made you decide to go sheep farming?
Well, there were incentives. Oh, I know, right? The government was trying to encourage it. They were paying transportation charges on breeding stock. You know. So I got that little bunch from Chapman.
They were suffered down?
Yes. We've been committed to it ever since.
That's something. So you were the only sheep farm in my...
Oh, yes. I don't know what in... Over towards Smithers had sheep, even at that time, because Gordon had trouble with predators, and he sold all that he had left.
And where was his farm?
It was up the Telquah.
To that farm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you just simply bought out all his flock. That's very interesting. And then of course you're remarking about all the different kinds of lambs, and you know, they were apparently the color and the twins and stuff. You're telling the kids all that.
Well, the children always enjoy that sort of thing, these little evil things, you know, because they're very human little animals, and not as stupid as most people think, you know.
And then occasionally you have triplets, I understand.
Occasionally.
And they are born black.
Well, the Suffolk Down are born black. And they turn white later. They're baby wool thinned. The new wool comes out of them, and then
that's really interesting. And you were stating that the black wool sells at a high price.
Yes, if you have a black
that stays black.
Yeah, that's not a Suffolk. There is a breed that will occasionally get a black wool, mixed color Suffolk, but it's frowned upon, and they don't save them in stock. But there is a breed that is black, and that wool is quite expensive. In fact, at $5 a pound 2 years ago, I don't know what it is now.
And then, of course, they take poor wool.
Yes. In this area, it's, there is market developing with the interest in hand spinning and hand weaving, things like that, you know. But otherwise, there are no wool grading stations in the West. You ship it clear to Ontario.
That's where you ship your wool? Every year?
And the wool growers in BC, they do cars at certain points. Like they load a car in Banff, and they load a car in Prince George.
For wool?
Yeah. so that everybody ships in or hauls in those points, you see.
So you take yours like the
and
battery.
Then they send it.
They let you know ahead of time.
Otherwise, you couldn't begin to afford. You couldn't. It would cost you money to sell it because you couldn't afford the transportation. Oh.
But so then they let you know ahead of time.
Oh yes, yes, they tell you what date they'll be loading the car. Mm-hmm. Please don't have the wool in there too much ahead of time. I guess they have limited storage space, you see.
So you go there about day before or something like that?
Well, I have always seen a train. I've never driven over there with it, you know. And you can get it in just as nearly as you can, right?
And how do you prepare it? Just put it in big
No, you get bags.
Oh, yes,
especially
special bags.
For that, they hold about 200 pounds.
Just
maybe a little more.
It right in.
They're about 4 feet wide and about 8 feet.
They're provided by them, or you just keep them for yourself?
No, you buy them.
Yeah.
And then if they are damaged, you get a rebate on the bag.
Oh, so they just keep them and send you
some
new ones?
That's right.
I see.
And the wool is always tied with paper twine. You never use a fiber twine. Wool fleeces.
Paper twine, for goodness sake.
Especially binder twine.
That means the wool itself.
Yes.
The fleeces.
Oh, yes. Because you have to fold them in and roll them up with the shawl on the outside. And you roll them so that the inside of the fleece is on the outside of the ball of wool. And the finest grade and the highest price is on the shoulders. Which is reasonable in a way. I thought it would be, before I knew it, it would be on the other end, but it's on across the shoulder.
The largest pieces, I suppose.
Well, it's quality of the wool. There are, I couldn't tell you how many different grades of wool there are in this. But it's a very specialized, what you would call a vocation, wool grading.
The same as furs.
And they roll these fleeces out on some tables and take out this portion, that portion.
Just cut it right off.
And put them in different places because they're different grades and they go for different purposes. Some goes for felting.
Have you been in any of those places?
No, I haven't. It would be most interesting. I've, read, they give us a lot of information about it. I expect so. We should prepare the fleeces properly.
I suppose, so that you realize money in your pocket.
Because if it isn't prepared properly, it takes longer, and sometimes it's almost impossible to do properly if it's all mixed up, and then you would get the lower price.
Sure. Well, it's just like the feathers on chickens when
that's
they have them for fly tying or something.
For fly tying and just for pillow stuffing or everything else. There's the down and the smaller.
Well, that's just really very interesting. Did you ever knit in yourself?
Oh yes, I learned to knit after I came up here too. And all of the old bachelors in the Kisbeox, I think every old bachelor knew how to knit, his own socks and mitts, and they used to poke a lot of fun at me because I was pretty soon, clumsy. They could just fly away.
So they'd get the wool from you, of course.
Well, no, at that time
I
didn't have the wool. But they used to buy yarn. You didn't have so many synthetics in those days either, They buy the wool yarn and make their socks.
There was a lot of discussion about all the care of the lambs, actual, headaches of the care of the lambs. you mentioned about, you know, how that you have a friend and how you had done amazing discussion. So, it's a matter of, I guess, in Lammy, it's quite a thing. You have lots of little jobs.
Oh, yes. If you don't take care of them then, you just as well not have them. That's what counts.
And I guess you check them Sunday night.
Oh, yes. Yes, you do that.
And then
sometimes they need help. Sometimes they, for one reason or another. And especially if it's very warm, once in a while you have to bring one in until it gets dried up and warm enough. You know.
Have you ever had to bring my flight that would be practically dead?
Yes, I do that too. I thought they were just little icebergs, you know. Picked them up and I had a pan of really, really warm water. I didn't know how hot, you know, it should be until I read an article in the Alaska Magazine about a baby that had found in the church vestibule in Anchorage, and it was a newborn baby, and they took it to the hospital and they immersed it in 102 degrees and revived the child that had lived. So
it has to have a really hot.
Mm-hmm. Because the little bodies are off quite quickly too, you know. And if I really had never taken the temperature of the water, I just put them in water that was so hot that I could just really bear my arm and hand in it without, you know, without scalding it. And then replenish it with hot water because it cools off so quickly.
And you just keep it in there for a while.
Sometimes you have to keep it in there for half an hour.
That's
right. Well, just the little eyes and nose are sticking out, you know, and I mean, they'll show signs of life before dying, but to just make sure they're really warmed up, it seems to be the best way to warm them up.
You just need to take extra shock to the body.
Yes, and then I rub them down with the heavy old terry towel, you know, that stimulates the circulation. Maybe take them off in a while and give them a good rub down.
Do you rub them with oil or anything?
Just a dry rub.
Just a dry rub. Just to keep
I do that would be an extreme case, but you do have it occasionally. And they turn out all right.
Just as soon as they can get their light back.
Just as they can start to wiggle around. And
pump their own.
And their circulation gets going. Want something to eat.
Normal. Well, that's interesting. And you mentioned, you had all kinds of trouble with wild animals, wild dogs.
Yes, we've had some problems, all right.
And I guess last spring really bad.
Well, the wolves were bad here, but they didn't get any sheep. Because, of course, they were here earlier and the sheep were in the feedlot right
next
at the building. We have the yard light down there now, which helps. We have gotten up in the night and hung lanterns are out, you know, before we have the light.
And they really, the light does keep the wolves
away? It seemed to, like. But the kill we have had, like, from wolves have always been along in June or early July. They're up in the pasture.
Oh, yeah.
And I think probably the wolves are feeding their young.
And they would catch the lambs, of course.
It's never just an individual.
Always a pack.
They're never just an individual that gets killed.
Oh.
They're six or eight and just leave the ground littered with them and maybe carry one away.
Oh.
And the worst of it is they're not all killed. Maybe one will be bitten here and then another will be bitten there and brought them down. Done a lot of real work on the minnow. And some of them have to kill because they're beyond help, and others you can save and bring out of it. But it isn't like some people seem to think, you know. They say, oh, they only kill what they eat, but it isn't true. They get, you know how dogs go sort of crazy. Some dog, they get chasing something, and it seems to be the same.
It's just like
same psychological thing, as long as there's something running and it's eating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, grab it and throw it.
And they're not necessarily hungry.
No. And then maybe the excitement is all over. The rest of the band has, you know, gotten close enough to the buildings by that time that
they want.
That they don't come any further. They might be able to take one and go. Because I have found 8 lying over the area of this room, you know, and only one missing out of the flock. Only one that wasn't accounted for.
So the rest would just be done in like...
Just for excitement, you know. It's like police dogs will sometimes go berserk like that.
Just excitement type.
Especially if you get...
I just love a little bit about that black bear that you shot and made from Alan. Apparently.
Let me see.
That's the one that pressed
yes.
up and...
He did it. Whether there were more than one or not, I don't know. There was one ewe and her twin lambs missed in the evening when I put them in, so... The next day I went out try to find out what had happened to them. And I tracked these bears back into the bush. They had a pretty well-packed trail where they'd been coming out into the oat field, you know, going back.
They've been doing this for several days.
Yeah, so when I did come a spot, this large bear was lying asleep at the foot of this birch clump. There was 8 big birches in a clump there. And I raised down under the alders about 25 feet from him. And he wasn't fully aware of, the wind was in my favor, and he wasn't fully aware of what was happening until he raised up a little and I shot him. Then when I shoot, bear just came from the other side of this birch clump. So I know that at least 3 bear in there, and I think there had been 4.
So of course ran away.
And the rest of them took off, yes. So I waited a few minutes, and I knew that one of them had come back, because the bush was very thick there, but I could see this darker patch, you know, through the bush, and it had come back listening. This one bear was making quite a bit of noise. And
the one that
yes. And so it was just a war of nerves. I stood there with the tree hoping that this one would come out a little better, and it didn't, so I fired a shot at it, but I didn't get it. There was brush and stuff. And I think it deflected. But when I went around the tree, here they had dug these 2 lambs up. Apparently the mother had been demolished probably when they first killed her. It was only a portion of one leg bone off her. And they had buried the two lambs because you could see that the leaves and twigs and dirt had been piled up over the top, and they'd scratched it away back feeding. So I think the one I got was probably the killer, because we didn't lose any more.
Leader.
He would have been the leader, I think, because he had probably been eaten and then gone way down there where he was, and then the others would go in. They probably wouldn't dare to feed while he was eating.
And you said that he was really long.
Yes, quite, he was quite a large black bear. I believe the one I have seen here, we measured, he was 8 inches between the butts of the ears. And when he was hanging up by the hind feet, he was longer than I am tall, you know, with his nose just about on the ground, 1 inch or so from the ground, so.
What do you have in the back of your shed for, or? Did you preserve it? Did you?
No, I didn't.
Only
hide tabs, you know.
I thought you had it.
Should have.
And then this grizzly was the one that you say was a had killed his calf.
Well, that's what we assumed after Ted found him sneaking up on our yearlings, because on a Thursday night, I believe it was, Dallas had had that calf killed right between the house and the barn. And it was just a small calf, probably a milk house calf or something, I really don't know.
And he just took it and went away.
So Sunday, well, I think there were, you know, I think that he probably left some debris there.
Yeah.
So Sunday, Ted went out horse to check our cattle, and that's when he caught this one sneaking up behind the bushes on the two yearlings sitting down. And when he had raised up right behind them, he was right in position to jump on them, you know. And he watched him stalk them every once in a while on his hind feet and look out over the clearing, you know. So that he was definitely stalking those animals. And his teeth were good and he's young, so we didn't think he had any excuse to start killing them.
No.
So
that was the end of him.
I think it must be the one that killed Dallas's calf too, because there weren't any more killings after we got this.
So that was Ted's turn to shoot that one.
Yes.
And mentioning that you killed several predators various times.
Yes.
Different animals.
Yes, I killed bear and coyotes.
Link will get a sheep, I guess.
Well, yes, they will. They're the lambs. Mm-hmm. They like that. At one time, I did get a couple shot cougar.
Oh,
here. It was quite late in the evening, and I was shooting downhill, and I overshot him. And when I came to the house, I told Ted that'd be an expensive shot. And about, just a few days after that, he killed a sheep in the pasture.
At your place?
Yeah.
But you never did get him.
And there we got him. Mickey Dundas and the chore here, they were small then. They didn't look at the lambs before they left. They went down to the corrals to look at the lambs, and there was a lamb in that had a big piece torn down on the hip. And the sheep were all in around the corrals, you see. So Kate, we got on a saddle horse and to look around, you see. And he went up the right-hand side of the field and see across something really white, showed up quite white. And he went over there, and here's a, the shore was lying dead, and the cougar had taken off. The tracks, you could see where he'd been lying, you could see the imprint of his body, where he'd been lying in wait there, just like waits for a mouse, you know. And when one came close enough, he must have maybe made just a swipe at the lamb with a claw or something, because even with his claws. And then he got, you know. And it was interesting, though, to notice. I knew this before, but it was never brought home to me that way. He had ripped her right down the stomach. She'd been bit on the neck, was killed, broke her neck, I guess. And she'd been ripped right down the, and the wool had all been plucked back, the edge of the cut, and it was in a little pile there beside her. It just looked like you pulled it out with your fingers. And then they eat from the inside. They will not eat hide or the wool.
No, I guess not. No, just started to eat. And did you ever watch it when you came back?
No, it. Bruce was here. He had his dog, and he trailed for miles south, and finally lost the trail. But we never saw the trail here again.
So it must have been chased.
So he must have just kept on going. Gone someplace else.
So you'd put it away.
It's only, well, she was dead and cold, you know. And
I don't mean for yourself, but
no,
I mean for
your. Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we dispose of it, everything like that.
Discouraging.
So that it discourages predators from coming around. We usually find a pile of it, you can lose things, you know.
And you mentioned something about some really good sheepdogs. Time to time.
Yes, we've had a few pretty good ones, and as I remember, the one we called her Nita, a little golden collie, but she was with border collie. And she was exceptional. She never left the sheep. She would go out with them in the morning and with them all day.
But when you train, when you start training them, you tie them to the.
Well, I didn't with her. Because she seemed to take to it naturally, I put her down, ever from Bill Quadras, and I put her down in a little kennel in the sheep corral. She was very young, you know, just about as soon as you could take her from her mother, and that's the only place she ever knew. The first time she went out with the sheep, she got loose. She pulled out her collar, you see. And I looked, and there she was running along behind them. I had turned them out, and they were.
Well, but she should have been staying behind.
Yes, she should.
She was
tired. I think she was old enough to go. And
but she was. So but she thought different.
Yes, they were probably 50 yards or so. All, they hadn't scattered in a group yet. Here she was, just running along behind them as fast as she could go to catch up. And from that day on, she never left them.
Which, of course, keep all wild animals.
When they went, well, if it didn't keep them away, she would bark, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much, I don't know how much she chased away, but I know that when she was with them,
they were never harmed.
Because that was one time that we had to get into them, too, was
would this be at night?
Yeah, it was, it must have been in the afternoon, and they have a habit of scattering quite badly, you know, and the wolf killed the ewe within sight of the barn. just up there a little ways. Apparently the main bunch were over quite a bit further. So the next day I went to check on them because I saw her, the predator hunter, what was on the scene? The predator hunter had come the next day.
My wolves.
Because we get in touch with him, you see, about this kill. And he said, oh, he said, and the lamb that was bitten right across the back, too, and it just had the four fang marks and punctured its lungs, but I managed to save that one. And he said, oh, he said, I think that's the dog. It's not that pup that you've got with him that's done that. And I didn't think it was. So he and came up to the house for a cup of coffee because Ted had just come in from riding about a quarter of a mile up through the bush and back again just to check around. And I saw the sheep up there running, and the dog was running way back and forth. And I thought, well, if she's doing it, I'm going to find out right now. So I sneaked up there. And before I got there, I saw a wolf coming right down through the... And where I was, I couldn't... The puppy left the flock, and she went to meet it. And the wolf turned, and not running, but just, you know, trotting along, taking his time, and this young dog running behind him, you know. And I thought, well, I'm going to lead her away and kill her, you know, because he could easily. And when they got out of sight, I ran. And
this was, he was going away now.
Yes, he was going. I ran as fast as I could and got some bushes and got further up, you know, closer. I couldn't get a shot at that time because I was a little afraid of hitting the little dog. And then apparently she got scared, and she turned around and started to run back. The wolf right behind her. And that's when I got that wolf.
Oh.
And the skull is over there under the tattoo, you see.
And he would have got her, of course.
And he probably would have. So then I came up, and the men hadn't even heard the shot. So I said, well, now, I said, you can come down and tell me whether it's a wolf or a dog. And he looked at me, sort of foolish. Said, did you go up there and shoot it? I said, yes.
You guys can have your coffee, I'll go tell
the wolf. And it was very thin. It was a young wolf, and large one, but it was thin. And that one never killed anymore.
I'll bet it did. And I was gone.
But the little dog, alright, she didn't know exactly what to do, and I think she was trying to get the sheep to come in, but because running back and forth through them, you know, barking, but she didn't have any particular direction, you know, to gather them up. I suppose that they needed a little more discipline. She was too young to really know what to do. But at any rate, she went to meet the wolf, and she knew. She knew
the danger.
So she stayed with him all the time.
And then when you mentioned one time when you train a dog, like another dog, that you tie them to the
I
neck.
Did. I had some after. Lost her, she died.
Oh.
Why, I had several, and they didn't seem to, just seemed to be as natural to them, even though I put them down their puppies, you know. So I used to just neck them to one of the sheep, so that I didn't give them very much. I used to use a hobble link, you know, for the horses, and put a strap on their necks. That way they didn't have enough length to get tangled up in the bushes. And they learned pretty well that way to stay with them.
A little sheepdog, like the one you're mentioning, the little one, would she come in heat like a
old dog?
And would you have puppies, or you would discourage
that
what would happen?
Yes, she never had any puppies. Mm-hmm. I would like to get a good young dog.
And anyway, you mentioned all the different doctoring you've done and a formula. I guess it's a formula for feeding them. You mentioned something about, what is it, you have to take yolks and...
Oh, yes. I have a formula for them.
And a pint of milk.
Yes. Yeah.
And a pinch of soda.
And
an 1/8 spoon of molasses.
Mm-hmm. Which is very little. And then I put them on straight cow's milk.
As near as there is to their mother's milk, I guess. Very interesting. So then, and you'd feed them that for several days or something.
Yes, not much at the time.
You mentioned they have to trim their feet. And
yes, they don't. The ground is pretty soft here, you know.
Yeah.
And when they're on the desk, some place where it wears their feet more, you don't have so much of that, but they grow rapidly.
So be the lambs
they don't wear
trim
back. The older ones, yes, mostly. The lambs will grow out to a certain extent too, but you have to trim all of them.
And then you get mentioned somebody at hoof rot here when it's terribly wet.
You do, you do. And you have to doctor them for that. There are two different types. It's just caused by the wetness, and there is an infectious type as well. Yes, you can vaccinate for that now.
Oh, you can.
Yes.
Oh, that's nice.
Yes.
So it's just like a bacteria.
It's yes, it's very much the same as the hoof rot you get in cattle, but there is a ovine strain and a bovine strain of the bacteria. So
your vet knowledge has just been from practice and feeding and from...
Well, yes, mostly. My stepfather was a veterinarian. I had access to his library.
Is this when you were back home?
Yes, when I was growing up. And
so of course you'd get to hear about life.
Oh yes. And at that time, when I was growing up, it wasn't ladylike to read veterinary manuals, but that was
what you like
what
to read.
I used to do.
How interesting. You would have made a beautiful vet yourself.
It would have been interesting.
Oh. Because you've always liked it.
I like working with animals, and I probably have more patience with animals than I have with people. You know, you expect people to reason more or something.
Like, for instance, what you're doing today, I think it's kind of interesting, that you save the, when you butcher lambs, save the stomach.
Some of the contents of the stomach. And then freeze it. It has the proper bacteria for digesting food.
And the lamb has trouble with that digesting if it just...
Well, since an animal who has gotten some kind of poisoning or something, you know, from some poisonous plants, some of those will kill the bacteria in the stomach, too. So that if you manage to administer an antidote in time or something like that and save her, sometimes it takes a long time to get on her feet for that, you know, from that reason. But the bacteria, a lot of those bacteria have been killed.
So otherwise that animal would just perish, eventually just...
Yeah, so it would take a long time at least to build up the bacteria.
I guess you, were any of your all been interested in animals or in caring for them like yourself?
Oh, yes.
Not
probably because of conditions here when they were younger. None of them were able to. Teddy Time was quite interested in veterinary course, but we didn't even have the facilities. We didn't have buses or anything like that to get them to high school. I had to go away. I think it discouraged a lot of the young people up here.
Of course, they're
going ahead and doing what they wanted to do.
And it would be costly.
Well, that was it. It was costly, and we managed to board them out to go to high school and this and that, but then...
That would be like in Hazleton. Good high school.
No, they all were going to have to find Teddy went to he went to high school in George.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's a long way.
And there wasn't too much money around in those days, and we couldn't afford to send them to university.
No.
So
they would have to support themselves, and
that's
they'd have
right.
to go.
Yes. And summer work wasn't, there wasn't that much in it either for young people.
Anyway, it's a beautiful place, and of course, there's no doubt that my goodness here.
It'll be 50 years next.
50 years?
Next June. We didn't come onto this place until May of the next year, 1929.
Yeah.
We lived down place where Gervat lived.
Oh, I see.
For
that's
the first year.
First year.
Because we went in there and the Adler boys were going north for Pratt Winter, and Matt Teagan, who was born in it, and we put up the hay in the place outside and fed stock and hauled hay.
For them,
yes, they didn't have livestock. All they had was pack horses. They didn't have they sold hay to the logging camps, because all of the logging camps used horses, you see. And that was a fine hay ranch, and they built it and sold it to the logging camps. So that's what we first went in, you see, we baled the hay. It wasn't in the field. No hay was baled in the field then. It was all put in cement, baled out with the stationary baling.
Oh,
later, you know. And it was horsepower. It wasn't a machine that ran the baler.
Must have been quite an odd-looking machine.
Yeah. Well, not really, but the there was a sweep, like a long pole, and your team just went around and around, and that ran the machinery.
My goodness. I suppose you had a lot of hair-raising adventures in all your 50 years. My goodness, that'll be...
You had a lot of fun, anyway.
You'll have another 50th anniversary for that. That'll be May 1959, eh?
Wow. Yes. Arrival here in the Kiskeox Valley.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, you say you were... Oh, I see. You didn't get your place till 1929.
No, up here.
Here.
We have the place in 28. Up there.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
29, this will be a big 50th
in 29, it will be 50 years. Place here, you know.
My goodness. That's beautiful.
It seems like a long time in one place, you know. And yet again, sometimes it doesn't matter.
No. Oh, I think maybe you could tell us about some hunters dad and your hunting season here.
Yeah. I think all I could say was that we had some interesting people, and we had some in who have been lifelong friends, and others that were people but you just didn't care whether you ever saw them again or not.
Normal.
Yes. And we came mostly to people who really appreciated the hunting itself, that were not unhappy if they didn't get a large trophy, but someone who would have to save up for 2 or 3 years for this one lifetime and really enjoyed the thing. They were just not out to get a terrific hit.
They were out for adventure.
They were out for the and naturally for getting their game, but they always took it. We never left. The only thing that we ever took without taking all of it was gold, which
we couldn't get
happened to be pretty inaccessible, I mean, for packing out, backpacking.
Well, you didn't. You yourself didn't go with them.
I have guided for moose and bear, where I could be in at night, looking after the animal, the family. But I hadn't.
Maybe on horseback you would go.
Oh yes, I hadn't. Sometimes on foot. I had an assistant license, and anyone who wanted to stay right here and that. I could guide by the day.
And of course, Ted would be busy working, probably.
But he would. I didn't go out on any of the trips because I had responsibilities.
During this time, Ted would have gone out.
Yes, somebody had to be home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to look at our stuff.
So where Ted would take Ted, and I suppose
Glenn and Bruce both guided.
And they go by horses way up into the mountains.
Yes.
So they'd guide, they would guide for, that'd be for
grizzly. And moose too, I mean, anything like that. But from here, we would be more limited, you know. I mean, there's grizzly here, all right, but you don't see that anywhere.
So that kind of the guiding and the hunting would have been maybe over a period of what? Maybe 10 years or so?
Quite a while. Mm-hmm. All right. Because Ted had an outfitter's license for quite a while. But I thought it was enjoyable. And I liked the horses, and it gave us an excuse to put the horses in
there.
You know, heaven for the hunters and the pack trade.